Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, the changing media landscape. Our guest is Andrew Hayward, who was president of CBS News from 1996 to 2005. Before that, he was executive producer of the CBS Evening News. He's a senior research professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Long-time listener, first-time guest.
Oh, I love that. Okay, before we get to the state of the media today, let's talk a little bit about you for some who aren't familiar. You started your career at CBS as a segment producer, right? This was about the time that Dan Rather took the anchor chair?
It is, but if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind going back to my local news days before that.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because they were certainly formative. I wish I could say that I had a long-time passion for journalism starting as a kid, but I wasn't that sophisticated. So when I graduated from college, like a lot of people at the time, I thought I was going to go to law school, and I thought I would take a year off. And you know, I was interested in journalism as a consumer. I was interested in the mass communication of ideas and how information got transmitted. And so I took a very low level job at a local station in New York. It was so low level, Mindy, I actually got the job because the kid who had it left for college. So it was a high school kid who left. So that's what it was, lowest of the low, literally minimum wage job. And it was an independent newsroom. It's now owned by Fox, but at the time was independent. And, you know, the conventional wisdom is in TV, start at a small out-of-town station. So I started at a small out-of-town station that happened to be on East 67th Street in Manhattan.
Oh, wow.
Channel 5. But it was rough and tumble. The adrenaline left the gland every day. It was kind of terrifying, but very exciting. So I got hooked and I stayed and I worked my way up the old-fashioned way from the very bottom. I ended up, after a couple of years, way earlier than I should have, producing the 10 o'clock news there. It was still in my early 20s. And then eventually moved to the WCBS, the CBS local station in New York. And then, so I was in local news and TV for mostly as a broadcast producer for about 9-10 years. And then, to your point, when Dan Rather took over from Walter Cronkite in the beginning of 1981, I came over as a segment producer. I was the first person to move directly from local news to the evening news, which was considered a very prestigious position. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was a contempt there for, or at least not a great deal of respect for, local TV news. That I remember they would call it local. they would say, "Well, Andrew, I don't know how you did it at local, but here's the network." So it was a little bit of a baptism of fire, but yeah, that's how I started at the network.
Yeah, that's funny. And that's what a time to start. I mean, you know, Walter Cronkite, most trusted man in America, and then Dan Rather's got to fill those shoes, and a lot of pressure on the news at that, on CBS News at that
point. There was, you know, I was, you know, too small a fish to really feel the pressure. I felt it a lot more later as I, bigger fish, but yes, absolutely. And everybody was well aware of that legacy. But over time, there were some good changes. The new executive producer, Howard Stringer, came in. There was an atmosphere that allowed for at least some experimentation, expansion of the news vocabulary, if I can use that term. I don't mean literally the vocabulary, but the mm-hmm. kind of stories that we would do and how we would do them. There was a very, very strong period in the 80s of ratings success, but it's a highly competitive arena. And, you know, the other networks obviously didn't stand still. And Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw eventually got their solo seats and were also formidable competitors. So it was an exciting time. It's important, and I think for this conversation too, to remember that the evening news had enormous influence. When Cronkite left, the combined share of the three evening newscasts was between 75% and 80%. What that means is that three quarters or four fifths of the sets in use at that time were tuned to one of those three evening newscasts. It's an extraordinary phenomenon in terms of the news culture. We could talk if you want about how that's changed, but just quickly to say, you know, now it's 40% below, so it's gone down to half.
Yeah, and for those who weren't around in those days, it was,
That's,
I said,
which is
it was,
most
yeah,
people.
like we were there, but it was like, so you had these the three networks. That's where you went for your news. It wasn't instantaneous like we have now. Most people had a daily newspaper that had a morning and an evening edition. So not only has what we consume changed, but how we see it, read it, or hear it. It's a whole different world now.
100%. That's actually going to be one of the big themes of this talk I'm honored to give on Cape Cod next week, which is the fragmentation of the news landscape. There's a lot of attention on the political pressure, the attacks on journalism that are going on now. And of course, we should talk about that. And we can do that today too, if you want to. But journalism was already back at its heels for a number of reasons. And one of them is the one you cite, which is the fragmentation of the news landscape. We had a common information culture back then, built around these mainstream sources that you're citing, which is certainly, network television, local television, but very importantly, a robust newspaper industry. And we can get into the detail if you want, but all of that has been under enormous economic, demographic, and technological pressure over the last decades, and that has completely changed. How people get their news. And the news site Axios had a great phrase. They called this the shards election, Shards, like shards of a mirror that is broken. It's a great metaphor because, if you look in a mirror, you see, unless it's a hall of mirrors, you see what's supposed to be a pretty accurate depiction of what Mindy Todd looks like. But if you're looking at shards, it's impossible to get a full picture because you're looking at just one little piece.
Yeah, I want to get into all of that, but for the local news, and now with so many choices, and I guess for TV news in particular, the advent of cable TV news sort of began that fragmentation, right?
Yes, I would say cable was a tremendous threat to national news more than local, and we can talk about that. So it's easy to forget that cable news has not been around for that long. CNN 1980, that is a long time, but Fox News and MSNBC weren't started until 1996. So it's not that long a time, but they've been very influential, and I would say disproportionately influential among people who really follow news and follow the political conversation, so-called news junkies. The audiences are not giant. They're still not as big as the evening news audience, for example. For any, there's no cable program that has as many people watching as NBC Nightly News does, even today. But they have a large, disproportionate influence on the culture, and they are different from the networks, especially MSNBC and Fox, and especially in prime time, because their business model really, I mean, they don't say this, but if you think about it, their business model thrives on polarization rather than on this unified news culture that we had before. We can talk about what was wrong with that unified news culture if you want to, but cable is really different. It's not just about news coverage. It's heavily driven by opinion, and that means keeping people engaged by appealing to their anger or their fear. And often giving them news that or perspectives that they already agree with. That's a very different model from what Cronkite was doing.
Yeah. And talking about that polarization, do you think that really started with the cable news, or was some of that started in radio? I'm thinking like, that we all of a sudden we had some of these shock jocks, and then we had Rush Limbaugh, and I think that had a lot to do with the sort of the change in conversation, the tone of conversation.
100%. Talk radio has been around a long time, and you have these major stars as Rush Limbaugh, like Rush Limbaugh, as you mentioned, and they absolutely were if you call it, want to call it that, the pioneers are certainly the people who started this trend and had great success. So yes, you could tune in to a program where your opinions were amplified or maybe molded by what the other listeners and certainly what the host was saying. The difference is that it's this combination, I think, of news coverage and opinion was a little bit different. That's what, because cable, especially during the day, they're doing pretty straightforward news coverage. You could argue that, excuse me, the story selection on, I argue it's true, the story selection on Fox is somewhat different from MSNBC. They have different perspectives, but they're still news channels. But you're right, they're actually modeled, the prime time is modeled on talk radio. So you're 100% right. I don't even think that's a secret. The talk radio remains successful, and now we have the rise of podcasts, which are arguably eroding the influence of talk radio hosts. But primetime cable news is absolutely in that ilk.
So how influential are the evening newscasts now?
Well, less than they were. It's the combined audience is probably between 15 and 20 million. That's still large. If you think of it as one program, the three of them as one program, ABC, CBS, and NBC, they're not, but they're quite similar to one another. If that were a single program, it would be a giant hit in today's fragmented TV world, 15, 20 million viewers a night. As I said, around 40, maybe slightly less, 40% share of the audience. So that's still influential, but the audience skews older. These are traditional news viewers for the most part. One of the big issues for the evening news, and there's no single anchor who has the kind of influence that Cronkite did. There's no most trusted man or woman in America. So that's a big change. And I think the other issue is that next generation of news consumers is not going to gravitate to an evening newscast. That's a very big change, Mindy. It used to be for decades that television news and newspapers would depend on a younger generation aging into the media habits of their parents. As they got older, they would start reading the paper, they would start watching local news, network news, because they wanted to know about the world around them, because suddenly they had children, they had mortgages, they paid taxes, they cared about the crime rate, and so on. I think young people care about news for sure, but they're not going to gravitate to a format of, a network anchor for a half hour telling them what happened today. And it's not just because of the cliche is they consume the news all day long and on their phones. People are busy, and I don't think they're checking the news, but certainly they know that if there's something big that happens, they know where to get it. It'll either be pushed at them, or they know exactly where to access it. So they don't have to suddenly, as 40, 50 years ago people did, let's see what happened today, and they know what happened today, and they know whether they care about it or not. They don't need anybody to wrap it up for them.
And that idea of the next generation, that's what we call the in public radio and TV, the backseat generation, right? So we have the kids. I just remember when my daughter was, she said, "Can you change the radio station?" No. You have to listen. So what about the news hour? Where does the news hour play in all of this?
Well, the news hour is, I think, very important. I admire it for doing in-depth coverage of important stories. It certainly can't be accused of pandering or being driven by entertainment value. It's a well-produced program, but it's, as it should be, quite serious, and I think it really is designed for serious news consumers. I think the it's I hate to say it because it's popular, but it's a niche. It's a niche program. And and I would actually say public radio is a much more widespread and influential phenomenon than the news hour is. NPR, which, as you know, is under attack in Washington right now. We're spoiled here in the Northeast that we have a lot of sources of news, and we live either in a big city or near a big city. But a lot of parts of the country, as you know so much better than I do, Mindy, you've worked at half these stations yourself. The local radio, the public radio station, can be the only source of reliable news. So I would say I'm not a knock on the news hour, which but the news you could watch the news hour, or you could watch network evening newscast, and you'd have maybe not the same experience, but you'd be exposed to many of the same stories. But the idea of strengthening and preserving local news, I think, can't be discussed without thinking about the role of NPR stations.
We're talking with Andrew Hayward, who was president of CBS News from 1996 to 2005. He's a senior research professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University. We're talking about the changing media landscape. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the changing media landscape with Andrew Hayward, who was president of CBS News from 1996 to 2005. He's a senior research professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so they used to give you a hard time with a local news, but local is where it's at, if you ask me, right? I mean, it's really interesting to note that while the credibility of journalists and journalism has waned, that's really more aimed at the national media. Local media is seen differently.
Well, I should be interviewing you because I couldn't agree more. I have devoted my life to local over the past few years. In fact, I did a research project at the Cronkite School about local TV news, underwritten by the Knight Foundation, about innovation there. And then since then, I've been working with local stations on a number of projects, which we can talk about if you want. And certainly on the newspaper side too, this rise of local digital organizations that has not yet in any way filled the gap that the collapse of the newspaper industry or decline of the newspaper industry has created, but at least is making an important contribution, is hugely significant. Let's talk about why. Local news cannot be demonized as fake. You know that the red light on the corner of Elm and Maple isn't working and hasn't been for weeks. And why hasn't the mayor fixed it? The reporters are online at the Stop and Shop. You get to know them. They're regular people. And the issues are important to you. No matter what your political beliefs are, you care about the quality of the school, the crime rate, the impact of climate certainly on Cape Cod, on your town. And so, you know, real estate prices, all sorts of things. So local news is, I believe, the key to reviving journalism. And again, I don't want to dismiss national news. I think for a lot of people, national news has become, and I've never said this before, so I haven't thought it through, a spectator sport to a degree. You can't afford to have local news be a spectator sport because it affects you directly. So for all of the attention that the fireworks and histrionics on, especially on cable, get, local news, I believe, is what we really need to invest in to bring back trust in journalism. You alluded to this collapse in trust. That's a huge part of the threat to journalism, and it certainly preceded the current demonization of mainstream media that you're seeing from the White House now. It's very alarming, especially among Republicans, but we have trust in journalism is at a record low in this country. The numbers that came out just last fall, Gallup, they're horrible. And local news is more trusted than national news for understandable reasons, because it's verifiable. Yeah. So I think, local is where it's at. I agree with you. And I'm a big believer in figuring out how to have it survive and thrive. And I hope that's what we get to talk about next week as well as here.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the things I want to talk about too is, you know, we see this local newsrooms shrinking, right? Whether it's newspapers or radio stations, it's a little distressing when you see, you know, especially when you've been somebody who's followed local news and then you see that there isn't as much. Look, go to a press conference. I mean, they used to be well attended with reporters, and now not so much. So as local newsrooms, how do you survive? And one of the things I think is key is collaboration.
So again, I agree. And I don't want to minimize the impact of this shrinkage that you're referring to. I'm sure you've reported on this on The Point, but in the last 20 years, more than 3,000 newspapers have closed.
Right.
And even though that's more than two a week, amazing number in this country, yes, there are new digital organizations, but there's a lot of churn there. Last year, there was the Northwestern tracks all this, the Medill Journalism School at Northwestern. There was a net gain of 81 digital sites, according to Medill, but that's because, you know, 212 were created and 131 closed. So we have a long way to go to have a, you know, local news infrastructure that in any way replicates what we had in the heyday of newspapers. I think we have several different avenues that we can pursue. One is philanthropy, which has been extremely important in supporting local digital news in particular. And for a long time, I think it was there was a mistaken attempt to just shore up newspapers. I think now there's a broader mandate to support news organizations that are digital native, that often have specialties, and that are, as I said, springing up, while also, unfortunately, also sometimes collapsing around the country. But there's also a burden on the consumer. I think I saw one statistic, I can't remember where it came from, but 85% of Americans consume local news, but only 15% pay for it. So that's alarming.
Well, that kind of goes to the maybe a mistake we made with the paywalls, right? We started a lot of them with no paywall, and now they put the paywall up, and somebody's like, "Well, why do I have to pay for it now? I had it for free." And I think that whole kind of business model is changing.
Well, that was, you're being charitable. That was a disastrous mistake that the newspaper industry made, with a few exceptions, and those exceptions happen to be doing very well today. So just for people who didn't follow this, when news moved online, we didn't really have apps yet or any, there were smartphones even, but news started moving online in the beginning part of the century, really. So to websites, and newspapers had been supported by subscriptions and advertising, and the belief was, well, we'll just move our ads online. What the failure of there was not to recognize that the newspaper ad model was based on scarcity. There was only, yes, you said there was a morning and an evening paper. That's right, but that's all there was. There was very few places where you could place an ad and have people see it. So, unfortunately, online, there's a, if anything, an abundance of inventory. It's there. It's ubiquity, not scarcity. And nobody foresaw the impact of targeting that that sites like Facebook and Google could use. So instead of saying, well, buy an ad in the Cape Cod Times because we index high for potential car buyers, that instead Facebook and Google could say, we're going to give you actual car buyers, people who are actually online shopping for a car, and we're going to serve them an ad for you, which is the more compelling value proposition for an advertiser. So, to your point, paywalls are essentially a subscription. That's what it is. You're paying to see the content, and it's become critically important for almost all publishers. But you're right, the expectation was it's free. And if you look at the television side, now, television has not suffered the same declines, but they've suffered severe declines in terms of size of newsrooms and economic pressure. And I totally agree with you, to establish a paywall now, if you're a local TV station, would seem like a very, very, very steep challenge. CNN is trying to do that now. They're trying to create a subscription service, and they already have, actually, so that you get certain content you have to pay for. We'll see whether that works out.
And just I'm wondering, and some of the local projects you've been working about with some TV stations and maybe newspapers. I want to go back to that collaboration, because for a lot of people, you have a smaller newsroom, right? So how do you cover
Oh, so that's my fault. You said collaboration. I went off into a rant.
No,
Was
that's
that?
okay. It was because it was a
Oh,
good one. It was a good one.
so
It was a good one.
you have
But
my official apology for that.
no worries. But
You're 100% right. And no, let me just say, I have been preaching collaboration, but that's a huge change for news organizations. So
absolutely.
it used to be that you would think of your competitive set as the other newspaper in town, or the other two TV stations in town, or maybe in a big city, the other three, or even the other four. Well, in the case of the newspaper, A, there is no other newspaper in town anymore. You're lucky that you still have one. And B, in the television world, what you're really competing for is the attention of the consumer. And you can do that with compelling, essential content, not just by showing up. I actually have a little bromide that I give to TV stations, which is, we have to go from being present to being essential. The comfortable oligopoly that protected the media for so many years is completely shattered in this shard landscape that we have. So collaboration becomes a very compelling strategy, because you can't do it all, and people want expertise and they want uniquely valuable content. So if there's a digital site in your community that's an expert on, let's say, crime or climate, chances are you can't afford to have a climate reporter. I know CAI does, but most places can't afford to have a climate reporter, a crime reporter. So collaborating with that other entity and then letting the news go out on their platform and your platform for mutual benefit is an increasingly popular model. We'll see if it becomes a very successful model, but without it, I think we're not going to serve the public properly. So you're 100% right. And again, I apologize for not picking
No,
up on
that's okay. That's okay.
excellent cue there.
I'm thinking because that's something we've always done since our inception is, when we first started, we had one reporter, was a science reporter. And we collaborated with the local newspapers to something big happens, we bring on, their reporters on our air. That's sort of this.
Don't you have a program where reporters are
We
around the camp?
do the roundup on Fridays. Yeah, exactly. And we've collaborated on special projects. And I think those collaborations are only growing because, we're kind of all in the same boat trying to cover, a lot with small staff. So, yeah, I think collaborations are
And you're
certainly
seeing
good.
some cities like Charlotte, Philadelphia, other places in Colorado that have become really the centers of collaboration, but it's starting to take on life, and for the reason you say.
Yeah. All right. Bonnie and Brewster writes, for me, the most immediate question is, how do we protect NPR from the Trump administration? Any ideas?
I can't. Hi, Bonnie. Thank you for your question. I'm not an expert on, the relationship between government and public media, really. I think the most obvious idea would be to make sure that your representative knows how important public radio is to you. The Republicans have very slim margins in the House and the Senate. We don't yet know. It's going to be tested in the court, I think, how sweeping the federal government's unilateral powers are without the consent of Congress to defund public radio. A lot of this money, as you know, has already been appropriated, so that's already being challenged in the courts, and certainly will be. But I think I think political action, meaning political engagement, is the most obvious avenue there. It's tricky. I mean, does your representative know your views? Does he or she come to the district and listen? But that's going to be a big political battle. And by the way, this isn't new. I mean, public media has been a whipping boy for a long time and often been a target. And I don't want to minimize the impact. It's very significant. But the good news is that federal funding is not the sole source of money for public media. And if it were, we'd be an even more vulnerable.
So, although it'll be interesting to see, because in some of those Republican districts, the local NPR station is really the only local news. And I mean, you look at places, like Alaska, and Wyoming, which the whole population of Wyoming is, like the population of the city of Worcester, right? You couldn't po possibly support all of that with the listener donations. So for
No,
someone,
you're right. We're not conflating, but we're talking about two parallel things. We talked earlier about the fact that in parts of the country, including so-called news deserts, meaning one or zero sources of news, NPR is unbelievably valuable. I'm not questioning the value. I think I'm what I said earlier. I think NPR is critically important. NPR station is critically important to the local news landscape, especially in underpopulated areas like Wyoming. But and I agree that listener support alone is not going to be enough. There was a study that public media did a while ago, back in 2011. It's come back to light now, which estimated that without federal support, a significant percentage of stations would have to close. I think it was close to I think it was 18%, if I remembered correctly. That would be a disaster. So I'm not minimizing that. But the other thing that Bonnie from Brewster can do is also make sure that she's doing what she can to support the station as a subscriber. There's a you know it shouldn't be free.
Talk a little about the impacts of social media. We talked about sort of younger people. They're not tuning in to the evening news, as you say, right? And a lot of them are getting their information on social media or online. So that has had a big impact on the changing media landscape as well.
Huge. And I think, unfortunately, I'd have to say at this point, largely negative. That was not the vision. There was a lot of hope that social media would be a connector across geographic divides, where you'd find people of common interests anywhere, else in the country, else in the world. And that has happened. Certainly, you can use it for that. But social media, similar to what I said about cable news before, thrives on polarization. That there's a wonderful journalist named Amanda Ripley who writes a lot about conflict. She has uses the term conflict entrepreneurs, and you could argue that the people who run the social media platforms, they're conflict entrepreneurs because they want you to keep clicking, and they do that by appealing to your passions, many of which aren't necessarily the most positive passions. So the and it doesn't mean you're never exposed to opposing views. That's a myth, but the algorithms, which are mysterious, are designed to keep you clicking, and they certainly have no interest in necessarily keeping you informed and in connecting you with people with whom you disagree. You can do that if you try really, really hard. But so one area where that's where social media has been deleterious is it's just it promotes polarization, and that's in its business interest to do so. But a second one, which again theoretically could have been very positive, is it makes every individual the center of her own network because you're allowed to distribute content, not allowed, enabled to distribute content, not just consume it by sharing. And so a lot of people, as you know, share irresponsibly. They share without necessarily verifying what they're sharing. They share because they are also trying to be engaged in the conversation, promote engagement in their own friends and followers. So you have this very complicated ecosystem where information, misinformation, one-sided information is shooting around, and everybody is the head of his or her own network. So again, we're not going to go back. You know, this is a Humpty Dumpty situation. You know, all the king's horses and all the king's men are not going to put the news business back together again the way it was, with again with a homage to our friend Walter Cronkite. But social media is, you know, has a lot to answer for here, and I don't think ever will answer for it.
And so that begs the question of, so how do we combat all this? And one of the things for the fact-based journalists is transparency becomes much more important, right? We have to be super transparent. And there are ways we can use social media that are helpful, you know, reaching out when you're, you know, looking for, you know, for some particular information or, but that transparency part is huge.
Well, I think you named two right there. So let's talk about transparency first. And that's the good news is that is a growing trend in news organizations, which is to move from the old system, which is pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. You know, it was kind of this magic is happening, and we are going to, especially in TV, was really guilty of this. You know, I call it phony omniscience, right? That everything was designed to build up the credibility of the anchors with the big desks and the perfect hair and the great voices and the nice lighting. And the whole and even you know the writing is all, if you look at it carefully, traditionally is designed to suggest that the anchor is omniscient and you know omnipresent. Though today's news consumers, especially younger ones, know that isn't true. And news organizations increasingly are showing their work. So if you're a news consumer and you want to know how a news organization got to a particular conclusion, you know, it's not universal, but it's easier to get that information. And good news organizations are good about sharing that and taking away some of the mystery, including saying what they don't know yet, what they're still working on. Plus, digital media, which again has a lot to answer for on the negative side, allows you to publish transcripts of interviews. It allows you to in-depth Q&As with sources that maybe didn't have room for all of it in your radio report or in your newspaper report, but you certainly online can say more. So there's if you're committed to getting to the bottom of important issues, there's a wealth of information available to you, including, to your point, you know, because of the increasing transparency where it's not magic, it's a process, it's work. And I think that there's a new claim to authority or an emerging claim to authority that journalists have to make, as opposed to asserted authority, which is all of the trappings that I talked about, earned authority. And the earned authority is that, you know, you went to your job as a teacher and you went to your job as a fisherman, and I went to my job as a journalist, and I went out and I did my best to find out what's going on. Here's how I did it. Here's what I still don't know, and so on. So I think transparency is a very positive trend, and I think it will help build back trust. The second issue you mentioned is listening better, and that is again something that news organizations have not done terribly well. Public radio has been in the vanguard for years on this, but the figuring out how to listen to what your consumers, what the people whom you're serving, care about the most. So, and you're absolutely right that social media listening, if you do nothing, is already a very valuable tool. If you just follow social media in your community, you know a lot about what people care about. But now there are also increasingly ways to overtly gauge what's happening in communities. You keep when you reintroduce me mentioning Arizona State, but I'm also affiliated with as an advisor to a center at MIT called the Center for Constructive Communication. And we spun out a nonprofit called Cortico, which has developed a fantastic process for small group conversations that communities, organizations can use to delve into people's life experiences and learn what's important to them. And we just finished a terrific project with 9 NPR stations around the country that used this to delve into specific issues in their communities with great success. It was funded by Knight, and it's just wrapped up, and it was a great pilot, and we hope to be able to do more of that.
We're talking with Andrew Haywood about the changing media landscape. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the changing media landscape with Andrew Haywood, who was president of CBS News from 1996 to 2005. He's senior research professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Okay, artificial intelligence. This is something, there are pros and cons to this, right?
For sure. There's been a lot of attention to the cons. I think I guess they're kind of obvious to the degree that they make it easier to create deceptive information that's masking as accurate news. And it's going to get worse. You're going to be able to create compelling avatars, and you can already do extraordinary things with voice that aren't sound very, very realistic. So separating the fake from the real is going to become even more difficult. And there's also the danger that it'll be a reason to cut newsrooms even more and to assign responsibilities to algorithms that were taken on by humans. That said, it can be an extraordinary research tool. And I think every responsible news organization now is wrestling with how to use AI in a productive way and what guidelines and guardrails to establish to make sure that it's not abused. Just a simple example, the ability to comb through vast amounts of data at extraordinary speed and cull out highlights or the information you want is really extraordinary. And something that things that would take humans forever to do, it can now be done accessibly, freeing up journalists to do more original reporting. So if a giant government report comes out and you want to figure out what the takeaways are, yeah, you can read it. But if you don't have time to read it right away, you can get a pretty accurate summary, especially when you're dealing with a well-defined set of data, not the whole internet, where you really can get into trouble, where the bots crawl out and bring back crap. But on the other hand, if you're giving, a finite document, say, look at this document and tell me what the main points are, that these AI services are really very strong already. So I think it needs to be carefully watched and considered, but not just demonized.
Yeah. Let's talk to Liz, who's giving us a call from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Liz.
Good morning. I just want to thank you so much for this program. My father, John Goode, was an agent for Ed Murrow and John Cameron Swayze, and I've grown up with all the newspapers my family could lay its hands on, and I'm a real advocate of morning news and evening news and evening television news. Couldn't do without it in terms of keeping myself and my family informed. And I just want to thank you so much for this program. It's critical these days.
Oh, Liz, thank you. Thanks for the call. We appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So the traditional journalistic objectivity is changing. We sort of touched on this. Talk about the cultural changes that we're seeing.
Well, objectivity is, can be a controversial word, as I know myself, because under the Cronkite School auspices, I co-wrote a white paper with Leonard Downey Jr., former executive editor of the Washington Post, called Beyond Objectivity, and how to create trustworthy news or produce trustworthy news in today's newsrooms. And our argument was that for years, the word objectivity was used to create a monolithic view of what's news and what isn't. There's kind of a top-down, editor-driven view that our argument is left a lot of communities and issues out, or at least off to the side. But the paper was to some degree misinterpreted as suggesting that we don't need objectivity. My argument would be we need the tenets of solid journalism, responsible journalism, fairness and accuracy, to sum them up, are more important than ever. A lot of newsrooms have stopped using the word objectivity, as you, if you read the paper, you'll see, because of the reason I said. But that doesn't mean that they're not committed to fairness and accuracy. I think the challenge is to diversify the viewpoints that are represented both in the newsroom and the news that we cover, but to still cover the news fairly and accurately. I think the you're seeing people trying to bring back beats and expertise. I think that's very important for trust and credibility. But also, newsrooms have become to some degree unrepresentative of the population that we serve, especially the elite news organizations. They're too dominated by college graduates, by Ivy League college graduates. It's journalism has a lot to answer for in that it was taken by surprise by the political changes that were exemplified by President Trump's initial victory in 2016. That's because there weren't enough people either covering or from the heartland of America where Trump drew a lot of his strength. So I think understanding communities better, reaching out to diverse communities and defining diversity very broadly, not just, ethnic, racial diversity, demographic diversity, diversity of military background, geography, education level. This is something that is an area where journalism can improve. And I think the, again, combining the core values, fairness and accuracy, with a broader effort to understand the complexity of the society that we're trying to cover is where we need to be.
Yeah. What are the, for news consumers, we know a lot of music stations, ratings are going up, right? Because the news is so depressing, people are tuning it out so much. So for those who are like, I just can't, I feel so overwhelmed with the news, how do you stay informed but not feel overwhelmed?
I love that question. News avoidance is a severe problem here. In fact, there was a study by, I think, Reuters, but US is like one of the highest in the world in news avoidance, 42% saying, we sometimes or always avoid the news. That's terrible for society and terrible for democracy. Well, so one of the metaphor I use is to regulate your news diet. If you think about information as calories, and there are good calories and bad calories. There's things that are good for you and bad for you. And really, I would argue that news consumers should become much more careful, much more discriminating in how much they consume and what they consume. This isn't going to change unless people make considered choices about where they spend their most valuable commodity, which is their attention, as we discussed before. So that means gravitating to sources that you find to be consistently fair, accurate, reliable, especially locally, where you can verify what they're reporting on. Do they expose you to other perspectives, not necessarily to try to persuade you, but to inform you? That's another big distinction I would make. To what extent are your kind of, let's call them marginal news consumption hours, the extra time you spend, wallowing in MSNBC or Fox, are they really helping you sit back and say, was that really the best use of my time today? Did I need to have that on in the background? Are there news organizations, to your point about things being dismal and dreary, are there news organizations that also take the time to not just cover the so-called, the good news that comes at the end of the 6 o'clock news for 2 minutes, but to also look for solutions. There's a major journalism movement called solutions journalism, which is really interesting, which is rigorous investigation of potential solutions to our most pressing social issues. Support organizations that are doing some solutions journalism. I mentioned Amanda Ripley before. Disclosure, my wife is her editor, but and I know her personally, but she wrote a terrific essay a couple of years ago in the Washington Post. You know, my friends are no longer, I'm no longer reading the news, and neither are my friends. That isn't the actual title, but if you Google Amanda Ripley, I'm no longer reading the news, it'll pop up. Making your exact point, Mindy, which is so many people have abandoned the news, and she adds three ingredients that she thinks journalism, as she calls it, for human beings, would exemplify, which are hope, agency, and dignity. So we all know what hope is. Agency is the sense that you can actually have a role in doing something about these problems rather than just feeling depressed by them. And dignity is the recognition of the dignity of every human being.
Yeah, we have like 3 minutes left, and I hope this is enough time to answer this question. But I'm wondering your thoughts on the surprise resignation at 60 Minutes of producer Bill Owens and Scott Pelley's comments at the end of 60 Minutes, where he basically insinuated that the show's parent company, Paramount Global, had started to push back on some of the more hard-hitting segments because of a merger that has to be approved by the Trump administration. What's your thoughts on all of that?
Well, he more than insinuated it. I think he said it. I give Pelley enormous credit. It's an extraordinary moment for a correspondent on a television program to essentially, maybe not accuse, but call out the corporation for interfering with the program's editorial independence. 60 Minutes, I was head of CBS News. See, I can tell you, 60 Minutes has always enjoyed appropriately an extraordinary degree of independence, even from within the news division, let alone from the corporation. I remember once a sponsor called the head of CBS at the time to complain about a segment, and the head of CBS appropriately said, "What are you calling me for? I don't tell the news what to do." So this is a very bad moment. And again, for listeners who may not know the background, I know we have only a minute. CBS's parent company is trying to do a merger that requires government approval. So the pressure on 60 Minutes comes from the fact that the company is trying to settle a lawsuit by Donald Trump and get FCC approval for this merger at a time when 60 Minutes is an irritant to Donald Trump. He hates it. He ranted against again last night, early this morning on Truth Social against it. He doesn't like news that is, as he sees it, critical of him. So it's a very, very fraught moment. And the resignation of the executive producer was an attempt to call attention to this issue. Very brave thing for him to do. Pelley, I think, was terrific and beautifully worded statement, judicious, appropriate tone, but it's an extraordinary moment. I think we have to keep an eye on it. And, God forbid we live in a society where 60 Minutes can't be editorially independent. That's
Right.
going to really be bad for America. It's the number one news program in ratings for 50 consecutive years, Mindy. We don't want that to change, not because of the rating, but because of what it represents in the journalistic landscape, which is a voice of fairness, accuracy, and truth.
Right. Andrew Haywood will be the speaker at the Cape Cod Speaker Series on Thursday, May 8th, 7 p.m. at the Tilden Arts Center at Cape Cod Community College. His talk is From Cronkite to Crisis, Journalism is in Trouble and How You Can Help Save It. More information at our website, capeandislands.org. Andrew Haywood, thanks for joining us. It's a fun
It was
hour.
really
Thank
my
you.
pleasure. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.